Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We don't see any real clear front runner among the types of strategies or methods upon which nitrogen can be applied, whether that's broadcast, whether that's banded dry fertilizer over or near the row, or 2x2 fertilizer placement that often is liquid in origins.
Ryan Heiniger is Executive Director of the Conservation Technology Information Center, looking at the results from the 2023 National Cover Crop Survey, and said, really, when it comes to nitrogen, no clear winners.
So farmers are basically using a number of different opportunities, of course, that would probably coincide with the equipment that they have or is available in their area.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I think a lot of us have been looking at both some old crop changes for demand and certainly some new crop discussions on production, wondering what USDA would do, and not too much different than what the general discussion and expectation was here.
Rich Nelson is chief strategist for Allendale on the latest World Ag Supply Demand, or WASDE, estimates.
You know, we certainly are. And keep in mind, even though USDA did lower yields today, now 175.1. So we're off by their starting trend by about 3%, which is relatively reasonable right now. USDA still has a large ending stock number plugged in. You know, last month, almost 2.3 billion bushels. Now still large, 2.2 billion bushels. So the trade will concern that at this point in time, we're not yet seeing a supportive argument yet on the new crop discussion.
That's the production side. What about demand?
You know, demand for corn, especially with the new crop, is kind of a mixed bag. You know, USDA's current numbers, they're implying about an 8% drop in total exports for the year up ahead. That's a little aggressive, though, because current export bookings are only about 41% behind average. So at this point in time, the trades will concern that we're not hitting these yield numbers enough yet to hit a bullish argument. And certainly for our questions on new crop exports, which are still behind, we might have a little headwind still in front of us as far as the demand argument in these weeks ahead.
USDA also looks at competitors' numbers, i.e. other countries.
For discussions on South America's crop numbers, USDA left Argentina's Finnish crop production unchanged. They actually did raise a little bit, raise the Brazilian crop number by 2 million tons. So add a little bit more to that discussion. And one thing to note as far as their 2024 expectations for these groups, no major change from last month's numbers. So as it stands, still a little stout new crop competition in these weeks or months ahead here.
But no matter what the number is, there'll still be some who don't think the numbers are quite accurate.
You know, and that's certainly the case right now. USDA's number, I think, in the trade mindset is kind of a question. A lot of us might say that the corn story is kind of wrapped up, a bit of an oversupply argument, and no major change yet to that story. For soybeans, this is still a little bit in play. USDA today, in the terms of numbers, they did lower the yield just slightly. They're now about 2% lower than their starting trend at 50.9 bushels an acre. The discussion as far as stock numbers, once it's all filtered down, 245 million bushels for stocks, that equals about right where we're currently trading, $13. Just like corn, though, we still have some questions regarding new crop exports. We have just a few weeks ahead of being better priced than Brazil, but that won't last more than 2 or 3 months down the line. So the trade still has concern that this 245 million bushel stock number may need to be raised in the coming months.
These are USDA projections. What about real life examples?
Certainly right here. So this month of October, of August, is actually quite important for us on a yield side, because we all see USDA's numbers. Now let's see if the private market gets in the field and finds that same argument here. Allendale does a nationwide yield survey starting on August 21. We've done this for 25, 30 years or so, and it's a two-week-long farmer survey. So we certainly encourage producers to get a hold of us, 1-800-262-7538, starting August 21, so just 10 days, and get on board and get your local area represented for corn and soybean and wheat yields.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So this represents what the five-year look-back history is for those who answered and using cover crops.
Brian Heiniger is Executive Director of the Conservation Technology Information Center on the National Cover Crop Survey.
Clearly, we are excited about the direction of this trend line, going from 325 acres back in 2018 to a reported 413 acres. A couple things to also point out is that compared to the last time we did the survey in 2019-2020, the acres reported was actually at about 465 that would have been reported planted in 2019. However, one possible explanation for this lowered amount is that we did have more horticulture farmers, and of course, the size of those operations probably comes into play in bringing the overall acreage down. But nonetheless, we are very excited to see this continued upward growth in total acres applied. And again, just I think further underscoring the goals, the benefits that folks are seeing, that clearly soil health and improving that on their operations is the clear winner, and the very related, closely related categories of soil organic matter, soil sequestration, further improving the carbon, improving water infiltration, you know, keeping that soil on the farm, reducing soil erosion, all among kind of that top four or five benefits. On the flip side, one thing to point out, I know, Dr. Myers will talk more about this too, is that, you know, very few are identifying that receiving an incentive payment is the primary goal. However, we certainly know from other surveys that, those incentives, especially for new cover crop users, does play a critical role in their adoption and decision. Again, new this year, some, more detailed questions on cover crop grazing along with cover crops following corn. And so to just kind of start things off here, this really represents to me a lot of untapped potential in that more than three quarters of the farmers currently are not utilizing or integrating livestock into their farm fields. Of course, that could be for any number of reasons. The infrastructure, physical fences, even hot wire fences may not be available. The water certainly would be another factor. And of course, just fewer farms perhaps having livestock for a lot of the Corn Belt might be another possible explanation. But I guess my interpretation of this is great potential for very creative opportunities for neighbors that do have livestock. And this starts to come out in some of the data as well. So 17% of the farmers do report utilizing that cover crop for additional forage in their operations. So this is, I think, more fascinating information and insight in that clearly a vast majority, some 77% of the farmers who do graze their cover crops own the livestock directly. However, again, this starts to showcase that perhaps there are some creative solutions. I know some states have livestock grazing co-ops, finding farmers that are looking for other ranchers, other farmers that do have livestock and would be willing to transport them seasonally. And so that 15.4% does reveal that, again, some farmers are seeing the value of having that cover crop grazed, all the fertility that comes with having animals reintegrated into the operations.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So artificially cheap, unhealthy food is not the problem.
From a Farm Foundation forum focused on food and the policies and practices behind dietary health.
And the low availability of healthy food is not the problem either. In fact, as our dietary health crisis was worsening, after 1970, fresh fruit and vegetable availability per capita was increasing. Even when adjusted for spoilage and plate waste, fresh fruit per capita availability up by 40%, vegetable availability up 21%, per capita availability of broccoli increased 13-fold. Much of this increased availability was made possible by imports, including from tropical countries and also off-season imports from Southern Hemisphere countries. We import one-third of our fruit one-third of our vegetable consumption, 1/2 of our fruit consumption and 80% of our seafood consumption, of course. If these imports weren't there, our nation's dietary health crisis would be even worse.
Dr. Robert Parlberg is an author and a recent guest on the Farm Foundation Forum, says food deserts are not to blame.
Now, some try to explain America's dietary health problem by claiming that healthy foods are more expensive than unhealthy foods, but that's not true either. If you look at the period from 1980 to 2006, USDA study shows that average retail prices for healthy foods fell at the same rate as for calorie-dense foods. Once you adjust for inflation and once you adjust for quality, processing, and seasonality. If you look at the next slide, at apples on the left and chocolate chip cookies on the right, you can see that the price was the average annual change in prices was showing almost an identical trend. But there's another argument out there that some Americans, especially poor inner city Americans, don't have a healthy diet because they lack physical access to the supermarkets that sell fresh fruits and vegetables. They live in what are called food deserts. This is a politically appealing argument because you don't have to blame the poor for their poor diet. It doesn't blame food companies or supermarkets either. That's politically convenient. It says we just need more supermarkets, mostly in poor neighborhoods. This is a popular argument, but the latest research shows that it's not a particularly reliable.
Instead of food deserts, he says, look at food swamps.
A couple of studies, 2011 study, actually found no connection between grocery store access and healthful diets. A 2014 study found that low-income Americans actually enjoy closer proximity to supermarkets than Americans who are not so poor. Other studies have looked at what happens to diets when new supermarkets arrive in a community, and we learn that diets don't change much. It's because supermarkets sell junk food along with healthy food. They often make choosing an unhealthy diet more convenient and more affordable. So the real problem isn't food deserts. It's what are called food swamps. If we define a food swamp as a neighborhood with at least four times as many fast food restaurants and convenience stores compared to supermarkets and grocery stores, these food swamps are a stronger prediction of obesity than food deserts. And in fact, if you control for food swamps, the influence of food deserts disappears. It falls to zero.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You know, USDA did two things for the wheat side on today's report. It was not just a yield change.
Rich Allen is chief strategist with Allendale, looking at the latest numbers from USDA.
You know, they do a 10-state in-field analysis, and they lowered yields just a little bit, 0.3 bushels, now at 45.8. So no major surprise in the big picture for the yield discussion. The second thing they did with today's report specifically, they did have a light revision for acreage. They revised small grain planted and harvested acreage. For today's reports, no major change for the wheat, only a 180,000 acre increase. So as far as discussion on the wheat side, we did see a very lightly net decline in production, but they did recognize a little concern with demand. Therefore, stocks were raised on this report, now 615 million bushels.
That's USDA on the domestic side, but what about internationally?
And this was really interesting what they did here today, because they were quite active in changing a lot of these production numbers. The net message for the entire world was about a 3 million ton decline. But if you look across the board, they were active in lowering a lot of these production numbers. Canada by 2 million tons. Looks like discussion for declines for China, 3 million tons. And as far as other action, kind of interesting that they offset a good chunk of this declining argument with a, in this case, 3.5 million ton increase for Ukraine's crop. Of note here, as far as the export side for Ukraine, they did not make any changes. So net message for us on this report, declining production net for the world, but still, in the trade's mind, probably not enough to move prices too much here.
And there were changes for cotton.
You know, USDA did a couple of things interesting for us on the cotton side. Just like wheat, there were changes for both acreage as well as yields. One thing on the acreage side is they did not touch the planted estimate. However, they did lower that harvested estimate. So they're now only implying about 78% of the crop will get harvested. So a problem not as bad as last year, but the general message is quite similar. Keep in mind, 2 years ago, we harvested 91%. Of what was harvested. So with a net decline in acreage, and also in this case, a net decline in their yield estimate, they were active with dropping production, 16.5 million bales last month, now just about 14. So your question as far as will we get higher prices, keep in mind these stock numbers, 3.1 million bales left over. This is lower than the prior 2 years. So certainly for the question for us right now is, if can we get today's rebound, last trade's up 250, can that rebound continue in these next few weeks?
But also very interesting when we look at the international side of the equation.
You know, for a lot of these questions, we've been kind of seeing some net decline, or we saw a net decline on today's discussion. And obviously the U.S. was a good portion of this decline. For today's report, as far as our competitors and whatnot, keep in mind no major changes as far as production movements. We will note that China, which gets a lot of interest for us on the cotton side, they actually did raise the Chinese cotton import, in this case by about 250,000 ton. Of note here for that cotton argument here on the China side, this is still over last year's number quite a bit aggressively. So we do have a hope that China does do a good, strong import. We'll have to see these next few months.
Rich Nelson with Allendale. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
So timing of cover crop grazing.
Brian Heinegger, Executive Director of the Conservation Technology Information Center, on the latest National Cover Crop Survey.
Clearly, the front runner here is utilizing the cover crop forage both fall and spring, with slightly fewer farmers utilizing spring only than fall only. One possible scenario would be, of course, after snow melt, runoff, concerns about compaction, among other possible issues. With spring only type of grazing. Just a couple of really valuable insights that clearly farmers who are grazing their cover crops are starting to see the value from a nutritional standpoint, other soil health benefits of continuing to build up that seed mix into 2, 3, 4 plus different species. And that holds true for both winter mixes, which of course would be like a cereal rye, a winter wheat, among other species that would overwinter, as well as summer mixes that perhaps are followed following wheat harvest as one possible scenario there. So folks are seeing the benefits of including more species in their cover crop grazing mixtures. And of course, we all think about and want to know ultimately what the both near-term and long-term return on investment and profitability components are for cover crops themselves. And I would say this is absolutely consistent with a lot of recent published literature in that, some 40+% are reporting a gain of $25 up to $74 per acre. So well more than enough net profit to offset the cost of, getting the cover crop established and all the different considerations. And so this is, again, more great insights from the farmers themselves. So they're seeing annual net profit opportunities as a result of getting the animals back out on the land. And real quickly, just to touch on managing corn after cover crops, I know from personal experience, talking to other farmers, this can be an area where perhaps they can get tripped up on with respect to possible yield drag and other impacts. And so these farmers that are willing to share their insights is really invaluable information. So we wanted to ask the question about termination. And so when looking at planting green, which of course would consist of planting the corn crop right into standing cover crop, maybe that's been sprayed and terminated just a day or two before, compared to 1 week to 2 weeks plus, when you add up those three left columns, clearly more farmers are taking that recommendation that I think a lot of universities have, as well as from other experts to terminate their corn in advance. But I think, you know, one insight to me is that those who are choosing to plant green probably reflects back to that 10 plus years of experience from so many of our respondents from this year's survey. And then finally, just thinking about that nitrogen management program also being a critical thought process and a decision to make sure that they're minimizing any potential hit to that early corn planting stand. So 44% are taking steps to apply extra nitrogen at the time of planting. I would also interpret that 17.7% that are choosing not to include winter cereals as kind of more of the proactive thought process and avoiding some issues with their carbon nitrogen ratios. And so while 38% are not applying extra nitrogen, the majority are taking that into consideration.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
People tend to look at the WASDE numbers and they'll look at global stocks. And there, you know, we've seen really divergent trends.
Former chief economist at USDA, Dr. Joe Glauber, on coming up with international numbers.
I mean, we've seen actually growth in global stocks. And a lot of people have pointed to those stock levels and saying, well, gee, there's sufficient supplies. But China is a real big issue here. I think the where a lot of the growth has come over the last several years has been in China. And they have varied, obviously, and gone up and gone down. But those stocks don't normally make it onto the world market. They're very difficult to assess in terms of the quantity. As you're well aware, there's a lot of difference between even the people who do these forecasts in terms of how much stocks China actually has, let alone the quality. And I think that for a commodity like wheat, that's particularly important. You know, is this, you know, a milling grade wheat, or is this feed grade wheat, or is this even lower quality? And, you know, I think many analysts, and certainly that would include, the work that I do, I typically take China out of the equation and look at stocks held by commercial or, you know, by the major exporters, because the presumption is they're largely in commercial hands, that those will go out to the market if there's price opportunities. And so that they are actually making, you know, those are what you're seeing being drawn down. And so I think that's, you know, to me, that's the main thing here. And so if I look at how tight a market is, or how tight stocks are, I tend to look at the stocks held by major exporters, or at the very least, taking China out of the overall picture.
Now, a year ago, he was talking about both Russia and Ukraine and some of the challenges with getting accurate numbers and reports from there.
Now, in terms of Ukraine, I think the big problem there, of course, is the blockage out of Odessa. I mean, obviously, the also problems of whether or not you can harvest a crop or plant a crop. But just in terms of the stocks that are within, you know, that are anywhere between what 20 million or so of stocks that from last year's crop that haven't yet moved. You know, the options are really limited. I mean, you've seen in the press a lot of stories about trying to move out through Poland or move out through Romania, and you have problems with the rail gauges being different. You have problems with trying to ship down the Danube, then out to the ports, you know, using the canal to Constanța and ports like that. And it's just, you know, I was on a panel with a Ukraine presenter the other day, and they were talking about that the costs were essentially quadruple that of trying to move it out through the Gulf. So you can talk about trying to improve that. And, you know, there's a lot of effort now of, one, trying to open up a blue corridor, as it were, or some notion that you could actually get grain out of the ports. And I think that, I mean, that would be great. But, you know, the probability of that right now, to me at least, seems pretty low. But the alternative, moving out overland to the west, the country just isn't plumbed that way, you know, and it comes at a really high cost. So it's great that some is moving, but I don't think that we should view that in the short run that there's a way of really, you know, having Ukraine contribute and get those stocks out in any great quantities, at least in the near term.
USDA's former chief economist, Dr. Joe Glauber. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Foot and mouth disease has been kept out of this country since 1929, but if it did show up and got out of hand, it could devastate the beef and pork industries and hurt the economy overall. That's why Congress in the 2018 Farm Bill officially created
the National Animal Vaccine and Veterinary Countermeasures Bank.
Or just the Vaccine Bank, as they call it. Dr. Julie Wallen with USDA helps run it, and she told us the bank acquires and stores foot and mouth vaccine.
But we also stockpile diagnostic test kits so that we can quickly detect other diseases such as African swine fever, high path avian influenza, classical swine fever, and others.
Dr. Wallen says so far the USDA has invested
about $70 million in the vaccine bank, most of that being for foot and mouth disease vaccine.
And USDA has announced another $6 million investment for this next year. Gary Crawford, Washington.